earlier, I called, pardon me, Mr. Henry Lamb in Geneva, Switzerland, and he is attending the climate conference there, where plans are being made that are going to influence everybody listening to this program. And so we're going to go ahead and play that talk, and then we can have a few minutes at the end of the program, and we'll go on with that. But right now, let's give you Mr. Henry Lamb from Geneva, Switzerland.
The delegates that are here represent about 150 nations. They are the official delegates sent by the nations that have ratified the Framework Convention on Climate Change. There is probably about 600 delegates here. There are actually three meetings going on simultaneously this week. Those meetings represent three subsidiary organizations of the Conference of the Parties to the Climate Change Treaty. To answer the second part of your question, the interests represented by all of these 150 nations certainly do not reflect the interests of the United States. Unfortunately, the United States delegation, however, has already agreed to legally binding targets and timetables for emission reductions. Even though those targets have not been set, nor has the timetable been set, nor has the cost of compliance been calculated. But the United States officially has already agreed to accept whatever timetables and targets are adopted.
Well, now, but how does that carry over? After all, we have a representative government. We have congressmen and senators who make our laws. You mean our duly elected representatives won't be able to influence what is done as far as the agreements that are made in Geneva?
Our elected representatives will have nothing to say about the protocol that is being developed here. There are seven delegates appointed by Tim Wirth, who is appointed by Bill Clinton. It is those seven delegates from the United States that determine the position that the United States will take during the negotiations. And once the protocol has been finalized, the Senate will have an opportunity to ratify or reject the protocol.
All right. And now what happens if they reject it? In other words, can Bill Clinton just go ahead and impose these situations, these requirements, as he has done with the Biodiversity Treaty, irrespective of how our elected representatives feel?
He certainly can do that through the regulatory process. As a matter of fact, that is precisely what Carol Browner is attempting to do right now by tightening the restrictions on air quality in the United States.
Now, of course, this is all based upon this presupposition that there is indeed a great threat from global warming. But, of course, we've talked in the past, and this is totally contrived, isn't it? And, in fact, didn't many of the scientists who met and examined this for the United Nations, weren't they angry when they saw that their work that they had labored so hard on to come up with a fair appraisal of global warming, in which they said there really isn't any evidence to substantiate it, and when that was falsified by United Nations officials, wasn't there a tremendous uproar over that?
Yes, there was. That did not deter the policymakers, however.
In other words, they really aren't interested in the facts. They already have a preconceived agenda.
Oh, yes. The policymakers have already decided that global warming is, in fact, occurring, despite all of the scientific evidence to the contrary. The policymakers have said that the scientists who disagree with the agenda are scientists who have special interests to be concerned with, that they are not in the mainstream of scientific thinking. And they have generally discounted the dissenting scientists and are moving forward on the assumption that global warming is, in fact, occurring and that the only remedy for global warming is the reduction of carbon dioxide emissions, which means the reduction of energy use.
And, of course, won't that impact primarily on the United States and perhaps to a lesser degree on Western Europe and the developed nations? This certainly is not going to impact on third world countries, is it?
It will impact in a very positive way on third world countries.
In what way?
Because this protocol that is being developed applies only to developed countries.
In other words, third world
countries. Developed countries will rush from America and Western Europe to set up shop in the developing countries where they are not faced with these kinds of restrictions and these kinds of taxes that will be imposed on the use of fossil fuel energy.
In other words, what you're saying is there's going to be just a gigantic sucking sound as industry leaves America because it can't meet energy or emissions requirements, moving to third world countries to build up their economies, industry as an industrial base, as America's industrial base is gradually declining?
That is absolutely the inevitable consequence of the kinds of restrictions that are being discussed here in Geneva.
Isn't that amazing? Now, how much are they actually going to force us to give up in the way of energy production? I mean, 5%, 10%, 20% of our energy? How much are they demanding?
That is precisely the point that is under negotiation now. It is no longer a decision or a discussion about whether or not to impose the reductions. That has already been assumed. Now, the negotiation that is going on this week has to do with the amount of reduction that must take place and over what period of time. There are presently 9 proposals on the table being discussed, the most stringent of which would call for a reduction of CO2 or carbon dioxide emissions to a level 20% below 1990 levels by the year 2010, and an additional reduction of 50% below 1990 levels by the year 2030. That is the most severe proposal that is on the table.
Well, now,
there's a great variety of lesser proposals. The one that seems to be gaining dominance among the 9 is a proposal to reduce immediately or by the year 2005 to a level 20% below 1990 levels, and then a longer term goal beyond that to eventually reach a level 50% below 1990 levels.
Right now, is that for the world or is that just for developed countries?
That's for developed countries.
I see. Now, are there any restrictions? Then there are really no effective restrictions on third world countries?
None at all.
And in other words, this then is part of the plan to simply destroy America's industrial base and build up the rest of the world as part of this this plan of globalization and creating equality for labor throughout the world.
That's exactly right.
Now, is there
language in the treaty and in the protocol, and the precise term is called differentiated commitments for third world or developing countries. Differentiated commitments means that developing nations may voluntarily take steps to reduce CO2 emissions, but are not legally bound to do so, while developed countries are legally required to take steps to reduce emissions, which means simply that industry will not just be sucked out of this country, out of America. It'll be more like a flushing sound.
You mean sort of like a stampede?
Absolutely.
Okay, fine. Now, is anybody talking? In other words, do the American representatives talk about the impact of these incredible laws and regulations on American industry and the disastrous effect it's going to have?
There has been no official cost estimate done by the American government. There have been, however, a great number of studies done by private concerns, industry in particular. One of those studies, takes into account the total economic impact of 80 nations, including the developed countries and the non-developed countries. And in virtually every case, there is a dramatic reduction of gross domestic product in each of the 80 nations studied as a result of any one of the three major proposals that are now on the table. And we're talking about a reduction in GDP in America starting from the year of implementation, 2005, if that is the year, over the next 20 to 30 years, we'll see 4, 5, and 10% reduction in gross domestic product.
That is
just an incredible impact on the American economy.
You're talking about a 5-10% over a period of 30 years, because ordinarily our gross domestic product is growing at a rate of 2 or 3% a year. So you're talking about then a declining domestic product, GDP.
Yes.
Okay, fine. Now, is there any opposition on anybody's part to this, or is it sort of a preconceived decision arrived at by all of the representatives of the countries of the world that this is what we're going to have to do?
There is some opposition from official delegates of Australia, of the OPEC nations, of Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and other oil-producing countries. There is no organized opposition, however. There are a few business and industry organizations here that have no official voice in the discussions, but they are privately attempting to influence some of the delegates, but they are unable to influence even the American delegates, let alone the delegates from the other nations.
Now, what about the automotive industry? Is the automotive industry in favor or against this? Certainly, what we're going to see is, of course, a demand for new cars on the part of people who can afford them. So many people are down the line are going to lose their cars. But, you know, down the line, I would think that even this would have a profound impact on the automotive industry as a whole, because most people aren't going to be able to afford to get a new car every 3 years.
The automobile industry is represented here among the business and industry groups that are here. But the position of the auto manufacturers is not very solid. While some language is concerned about the speed and the impact, the economic impact of the measures that are being discussed here, the automobile industry also stands to benefit tremendously with the conversion to electric automobiles, especially when the law requires the utilization of automobiles that do not use fossil fuel energy. So they're not talking very hard about stopping the protocol. They are interested in making sure that they are able to develop the new technology within the constraints of the time frame required by the protocol. That's my take on the discussions of the auto industry that I've heard here.
Well, now, you know, we hear about electric cars, but, you know, they only go about 80 or 100 miles. Are they talking then about perhaps putting the power into the roadways? And we've heard talk about that, where the cars can actually pick up electromagnetic power from the roadways, and then you cars can go a much longer distance, but you would then pay a toll for the power that you'd used. How are they planning on converting us from fossil fuel-burning automobiles to electric automobiles from a rational point of view?
Well, there are a number of experiments underway out there. This new electric automobile that General Motors just introduced in California is the result of one of those experiments. But as you are aware, the car itself is not for sale. It can only be leased because it is so terribly expensive. The batteries only last 3 years, and it only has a range of 70 to 90 miles. But there are a number of other experiments funded by government that are underway. It's $140 million issued in the form of grants to various companies to develop longer-range batteries, and that is a very small amount on an annual basis, and that is just from America. There's $2.3 billion available through the United Nations Global Environment Facility that can be used for the development of technology to help achieve these goals. And that's why I say the automobile industry is not too terribly concerned about the protocol, because they stand to gain as a result of being in the forefront of developing the new technology, and then we'll have the new automobiles to sell at a much higher price than cars now sell for.
But, of course, that's going to impact on most of our listeners, because they're not going to have the money to buy those more expensive cars.
That's very, very true. They're going to be priced out of their cars anyway before that technology becomes available. These new regulations that EPA has announced carries with them 39 possible new restrictions, all of which increase the price of driving an automobile.
39?
A straight 50-cent per gallon tax on gasoline to a whole array of additional charges that ultimately will make driving just too expensive for the average person, forcing people into rapid transit, bicycles, or to stay at home.
Or in other words, everybody will have to live in the city like they do in China or in any other planned society.
That's precisely right, and it is coordinated nicely with the President's Council on Sustainable Development's effort to create what's called sustainable communities. That process has been underway for nearly a year now and is taking place in virtually every city in the country.
And by
it is all part and parcel of a very extensive global agenda to achieve total control, actually, of virtually every aspect of human life.
Now, is that Agenda 21 that you're speaking of?
Yes.
Okay, fine. So basically, you see this then as a move on the part of someone or some force or some organization to massively expand control over everybody, over everything, and to bring it all under a centralized planning control?
There's no question about it. There's no conspiracy about it. It is all published in a variety of documents. Agenda 21 is by far the most comprehensive document as it relates to social engineering. But the method or the mechanism by which it is coming about is hard to visualize. It is happening through a laundry list of international treaties that must be enforced by national governments, but implemented through a collaborative effort of NGOs or non-government organizations working together with various agencies of government. And we're seeing that in land use regulations. We're seeing it in all kinds of environmental regulations, especially air quality regulations relating to climate change. We're seeing it throughout the educational institutions. We're seeing it throughout business, implemented through the World Trade Organization, and we're seeing it in the financial community, implemented through the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and the recently recommended new Economic Security Council.
Now, what happens if a country, for one reason or another, doesn't want to go along with this? How can they be forced, or will it be that they won't get any foreign aid, they'll be isolated, as has recently happened to Burundi, with no trade from the adjacent countries? Or how will they force countries which, for one reason or another, say, hey, we don't want to do this?
Well, the United States is about the only country left in the world that is strong enough in its own right to survive outside this sphere. Smaller countries have no choice because, as you suggest, the international aid is pegged directly to compliance with the UN agenda. And the stronger a nation complies, the more money is available. country that does not comply just simply has the faucet turned off.
In other words, they will have no more foreign aid, and they will have increasing, perhaps, domestic and other problems within their communities. Do you think that possibly sometimes turmoil or the opposite political party could be financed in that country if the current administration isn't going along with the globalist agenda?
That is happening already.
Really?
The money flows from the United Nations through non-government organizations in various states to achieve the UN agenda. There is no better example of where and how that has worked, even over the last 10 years, than in Brazil. Incredible amounts of money has flowed from the United Nations and from a private foundation to nonprofit organizations, selected nonprofit organizations that happen to be accredited to the UN in Brazil, that actually flows into political campaigns. And that happens in every country throughout the world.
In other words, we get the finest politicians that money can buy in country after country, huh?
That's right. And much of that money comes from the pockets of hardworking taxpayers in America, because we finance 25 to 33% of the total UN expenditures.
I love that line. You know, foreign aid is where you take money from the poor people in a rich country to give to the rich people in a poor country. And of course, usually they're the politicians who will certainly carry out the political agenda that's been laid down from above. Now, as you see this thing unfolding, how soon do you think we're going to begin to see the impact of these environmental rules and regulations on air quality really coming down and beginning to limit the ability of people to use their cars and to be able to travel freely? Are we talking about a year, 5 years, 10, 20 years?
According to the documents that I have read from the EPA, the time frame for implementation of most of the 39 proposals that have been identified by the EPA can be implemented within 12 to 24 months. Now, which of those proposals are selected for implementation first is unknown at this point, and it is highly unlikely that they will attempt to implement more than a few of those programs right away. I think that we will see the effects of this agenda at work within the next 12 to 24 months, and then it will continue to worsen over the next 12 to 24 months. I would be surprised if the price of gasoline, for example, in the United States in the year 2000 is less than $2.50 a gallon.
Well, certainly.
I would also be surprised if the price of domestic electricity is less than doubled by the year 2000.
And so they're intentionally going to raise the price of both energy and gasoline so that people just won't use it. In other words, what we've had for so many years is very cheap electricity and cheap gasoline. And now that we've, the people have, gotten so used to these things, now we're going to find the other side of the coin. We're going to find that they're going to begin to squeeze to force us to comply with the plans of the internationalists.
Yes. And it is underway at the moment. This announcement by Carol Browner the other day, and it is significant that new regulation was announced late in the afternoon on Wednesday before Thanksgiving.
And right after the elections, of course, so that wouldn't
sure.
disturb the people who were going to the polls. They would understand the impact that another 4 years of Bill Clinton in the White House is going to have on our individual and personal freedom.
Yes, and people need to be aware of that. These 39 measures were discussed and published on May 31st, 1994. They were published in a document labeled for internal discussion only. The document was not supposed to have gotten outside the EPA and did not until recently. But it was just after the election and the day before Thanksgiving, so that the news media could not make too big of a deal out of it, that the new regulation was announced.
Now,
the implications of these new regulations are absolutely horrendous. And so far, there has been almost no discussion or debate about those regulations in the media. The media did announce the regulations. Carol Browner was on Sunday morning television claiming that these new regulations had to be implemented. But so far, there has been almost no discussion or no debate about those new regulations.
Now,
the thing about it, Stan, that struck me as I read those proposals is almost all of the 39 measures that have been identified can be implemented without congressional action. Even the 50-cent per gallon gasoline tax can be implemented without congressional action.
Well, the people voted for Bill Clinton knowing that he didn't tell the truth, that he promised a tax cut when he first came in, and instead he raised the taxes. And people sort of went right along with it just anyway, unconcerned about the fact that you couldn't believe a thing that he said, unconcerned about his moral status, because it almost seems like our people have lost their moral foundation. Now, what indeed are these 39 items that are going to be decided upon or are being decided upon, and how are they going to impact us?
Well, I'll mention just a few. Of course, the 50-cent per gallon gasoline tax will be the most dramatic.
Right.
It will not be the first, but it will be coming down the road. Another very important item is, I'm sure you are aware, that federal highway funds are made available to the states on the basis of matching grants. One of the requirements will be of the federal government that states match highway money only with revenues raised from additional gasoline taxes.
Oh, isn't that interesting? In other words, we will have not only a federal but a state gasoline tax?
Yes. And beyond that, there is one of the 39 recommendations is called a pay-at-the-pump insurance plan, where an additional premium of 25 cents per gallon is added to the price of gasoline to offset the cost of uninsured motorists. These are just three of the 39 proposals, and they are really bizarre, yet they are proposals that can be implemented administratively through the rulemaking process, and they will be implemented in areas of non-attainment. And the regulations that Carol Browner has proposed will increase the number of non-attainment areas in America from the current 75, and these are major cities primarily such as Los Angeles and the cities around Los Angeles, Denver and Chicago and New York. There are now 75 non-attainment areas, but under the new regulations that Carol Browner has proposed, there will immediately be 214 non-attainment areas.
I'm going to have to interrupt you there just for a moment, and we'll be back in just a moment with Mr. Henry Lamb. Okay, well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course we have on the line with us from Geneva, Switzerland, Mr. Henry Lamb, and this is a program that was pre-recorded earlier in the day so that we could bring you the message of these fast-breaking concepts that are coming out of Geneva that are going to impact on every single one of you, but of course you're not getting this material from the regular left-wing media. Mr. Lamb was telling us about what's being planned as far as the federal gasoline tax, the new state gasoline taxes, the unemployed drivers insurance taxation, uninsured driver taxation program. What else do they have in store for us?
They have additional fuel economy, fuel efficiency standards. The current standard in America is 27.5 miles per gallon for automobiles. That will be extended over time to 45 gallons per mile, 45 miles per gallon.
Right.
that has the impact of reducing the weight of automobiles and reducing the safety of automobiles and increasing the price of automobiles. And their estimate, EPA's estimate, is an increase of about $4,000 per car for fossil fuel burning automobiles to meet those fuel efficiency standards.
Now, basically, are they going to require the electric cars in those areas like Los Angeles and Chicago and Denver and New York you were talking about, and then allow the fossil fuels in the more rural areas, or are they going to impact on every area as far as the electric cars are concerned?
Well, much of that has yet to be determined in the regulations. But in California, as you're aware, 10% of the vehicles must now be alternatively fueled vehicles, electric or other. That same kind of percentage pressure will be applied to all non-attainment areas. And many of the non-attainment areas will be rural. The percentage will increase, but the alternatively fueled vehicles will not necessarily be electric vehicles. They can be any kind of alternatively fueled vehicle. And those alternative fuels, of course, have to be approved by the EPA. Another one of the provisions that is already underway, the federal government has committed to convert its fleet of vehicles to alternatively fueled vehicles. Bill Clinton issued an executive order shortly after coming into office indicating that he would speed up that process and convert 50% of the fleet to alternatively fueled vehicles by 1999, I believe is the year. Those are a few of the measures that have been discussed. There is another very important measure that will be implemented in all the non-attainment areas, and that is the requirement for vehicle emission inspections based on miles driven. In other words, the more miles an automobile is driven, the more frequently his car must be inspected. The cost of that inspection must be borne by the owner, and the cost is expected to be from zero to several hundred dollars per inspection based on the emissions that the car produces. In other words, if you have a low-emitting automobile, the inspection fee will be minor. But if you have an old junker that pollutes, then the inspection fee could range into the hundreds of dollars.
Okay, fine. So basically, if you drive a great deal, they're going to punish you by making you go down and get smogged over and over again. And, of course, this begins to get pretty expensive if it's hundreds and hundreds of dollars every time, every year, you have to get your car smog checked. And then, of course, if they find something wrong with it, then what happens?
Then the car must be parked until it is fixed. There are two states that already have laws, and these are state laws based on federal standards. But in New Jersey, for example, the automobile must be parked until it is repaired. Then it may be inspected again. You have one opportunity to repair it a second time. If it still fails, then the car must be disposed of. And if it is not disposed of according to the state plan, the state will confiscate the vehicle, and period, no compensation, and you will not even be able to park the car in your driveway or on your property. It can no longer exist.
All right. Now, basically, are they still going to have these pollution credits like we have today so certain industries can continue to pollute by buying up pollution credits, or is that whole concept going to go by the wayside with these new laws that are coming in?
That concept is likely to stay in place.
In other words,
and in fact, it is likely to be expanded. That is one of the issues that is being discussed here this week, is to expand that pollution credit trading permit to a global basis. And it has not yet been decided here in Geneva whether or not that will be allowed in this protocol, but it is an issue that is being discussed, and it is an issue that is favored by the United States.
I know for our listeners, basically, that is every car that is crushed. Now, you won't get the money, but somebody will get the money, a credit for the crushing of a car that then could be sold to industry so they can continue polluting. We've got the car off the road. We've done away with mobile pollution. And now, of course, we can then allow more fixed pollution, which, of course, is madness. But then so much of what you're really describing today is really madness. So the pollution credit matter is still up in the air.
That's right.
Okay. Now, it sounds like, then, like everything is being done for the creation of a totally planned and regulated society, and using the backdrop of global warming to justify this massive increase, draconian increase of control over the lives of our people.
And this meeting here this week focuses purely on climate change issues, fossil fuel energy. But as I suggested, the other meeting that is going on this week in Singapore has to do with the World Trade Organization. Now, the two meetings have a very solid connection. One of the issues being discussed here is how to enforce this treaty. The answer is to require the World Trade Organization to impose sanctions against countries that are not in compliance with this treaty. Now, while we are talking in Geneva, there is another 1,000 or so delegates talking in Singapore about how to go about enforcing trade sanctions against countries in non-compliance with this treaty that we're discussing in Geneva. It is an extremely well-coordinated agenda by the United Nations organization aimed at enforcing all people in every nation to live by the agenda that has been contrived over the last several years by the United Nations system.
That is really incredible, and it's almost as if this whole thing is planned out, you know, and on one hand you have the World Trade Organization, which, of course, has just gotten through, what, 3 or 4 years ago, not even that long, and now they can use WTO to force everybody into environmental compliance.
Yes. This is a point back when the World Trade Organization was being debated in the Senate. We opposed the World Trade Organization, and the primary reason we opposed it was because in the preamble of the World Trade Charter, there is a provision for enforcement of environmental treaties. Very few people knew that, and very few senators seem to be concerned about that.
I think probably
even home to roost now with this treaty protocol that is being developed here in Geneva.
But nobody even knew what was in that treaty. I think there was only one senator, Senator Brown of Colorado, who actually read the treaty. It was so long, and of course, you know, they weren't allowed to make any suggestions. And of course, we can thank Robert Dole for pushing that through.
Well, that unfortunately is history, and we now have to live with it. The only solution that I can see, Stan, is to withdraw from the climate change treaty and to begin a process of analyzing the impact of the various other treaties that are so drastically impacting domestic policy. There are a number of treaties that we really ought to withdraw from, and by all means, we need to prevent ratification of several of the treaties that will be presented for ratification early in the next session of Congress.
Well, fortunately, we have at least a more conservative Senate than we've traditionally had, with supposedly 55 Republicans. Now, I suspect some of those are rhinos. That means Republican in name only. But it's going to be very interesting to pass a treaty. You have to have a two-thirds majority, don't you?
You only have to have 51 votes to ratify.
Oh, really? It's a simple
majority.
A simple majority to pass the treaty. Well, that's rather frightening, because I'm sure that they can buy the support of enough of those senators to get them to compromise their principle.
It is extremely frightening, because even though there are 55 Republicans, we know of at least 10 Republicans who already support this climate change treaty. We have a lot of work to do in the Senate to convince the senators not to ratify this treaty and not to ratify four other treaties that Bill Clinton has already said he would present for ratification in the next session.
Now, what will those other treaties be?
One will be the Law of the Sea Treaty.
Okay.
The other will be the Rights of the Child Treaty.
Oh, well, that's a disaster.
Yes. Another is a treaty on the status of UN personnel. And the other is a treaty on desertification. There will also be the chemical weapons ban treaty will be presented again. That's five treaties that will be presented early in the next session of Congress.
Well, let's hope that we get gridlock and deadlock and all of those lock situations, because the last thing we want to do is give more and more of our freedom away, or allow, as Gardner Cowles wrote in, Richard Gardner wrote in April of 1974 in Foreign Affairs, an end run around our Constitution so they can bring in world government over the objections of the people in the Senate. And it almost seems that's exactly what they're doing.
That is the plan. That's the strategy. That's what they're trying to do. That's why it's so important that programs like yours inform people about what's going on, because they certainly do not hear it in the media.
No.
The consequences of these treaties are absolutely devastating. People can't really contemplate the impact that a reduction of energy of the magnitude that is required under this treaty will have on their daily lives. And once it is in place, it is 10 times more difficult to repeal than it is to prevent in the first instance.
And then, of course, if we did try to repeal it, then, of course, World Trade Organization could be used against America.
That's exactly right.
And I think
there is a process by which we can withdraw from the treaty, and even from the World Trade Organization. But there is no political will in the current administration to do so. There is very little political will in Congress to do so. And the only way we can generate that political will is through the power of the people. And it takes informed people to make that commitment and to put that pressure on the elected officials.
Well, that's why I think your work is so vitally important, Henry, because you go to these meetings and you know what's going on, and then, of course, you give that information to us, and we have a small voice, and, of course, many of our programs are copied and duplicated and sent across America and heard on other stations. So at least we have an opportunity to let people begin to understand what's really going on with the hope that they'll be motivated to become involved, because, you know, so many people really think this can't happen here. But when they begin to see their inability to drive a car, their inability to, even in many instances, to use a gas-driven lawnmower, because that is polluting the environment, they're going to begin to understand that down the line they're going to lose all of these wonderfully, these hard-fought-for freedoms that we've enjoyed here.
That's absolutely correct.
Well, now, is there, of course, you over in Geneva now attending the meeting, are there other people there who share your concern about what is happening and the impact this is going to have on the lives of the average American and, in fact, the lives of the average citizen throughout the world?
There are some. There are. We are in the distinct minority. We are outnumbered at a ratio of about 10 to 1. I have met other people from other countries, Australia in particular, Venezuela, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and a few other countries, people who share our concerns, perhaps not on every issue, but our general concern about the growing power of the United Nations and its tendency to intrude on national sovereignty. There is a growing awareness around the world and concern about that United Nations power. And we are attempting to identify those folks in an effort to begin to coordinate our efforts so that we can have a little more influence at the international level.
Well, of course, I could understand why Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, the oil-producing countries would be horrified at this, because as we begin to cut back on the utilization of oil, this is going to devastate their economies.
Absolutely.
As we've devastated the economy of Iraq by making them incapable of selling oil, so the same thing will have dramatic effects on Kuwait, on all those little oil kingdoms along the Arabian Peninsula there, certainly on Saudi Arabia, even on Iran. Of course, it's going to influence Venezuela. It's going to influence oil-producing countries all throughout the world that have based their entire economies on production of oil, which has had such a tremendous benefit and influence for good throughout the world.
It certainly will. And in the analysis that I was referring to earlier, and that analysis was done by Charles River Associates, a gentleman named David Montgomery did the work. He calculated the economic impact on those countries, and it is just absolutely devastating. And the thing that is so strange to me is that no one here in Geneva even is concerned about the cost-benefit analysis for all of the costs that we know will be incurred as a result of this protocol. Nobody has attempted to quantify the benefit, if any, of imposing these draconian regulations. It just seems so stupid to take these kinds of political measures to achieve an agenda objective without weighing the costs and without measuring the benefits. It is being done. We're seeing it happen day by day by day.
Well, now, any industrialized society depends upon energy, and without energy, and I'm talking about electricity primarily, you cannot have an industrialized society. All the wonderful byproducts of that industrialized society, as far as prolonging life and health and quality of life, how is this going to impact on energy production? And, of course, you mentioned under energy consumption that you anticipated the cost of electricity was going to double within the next few years?
Before the end of the century.
Now, what impact is the cutting back on the use of electricity going to have on the maintenance of our economy here in the United States?
Well, we cannot maintain the economy if our energy source is decreased or the price doubled. And, of course, that is the objective. Throughout the discussions here in Geneva, I have heard repeatedly the complaint that with only 20% of the population of the world living in America, America is responsible for 80% of the pollution in the air and around the world. Therefore, we must reduce the consumption in America.
But
there is no quicker way to achieve that reduction in consumption than to increase the price of electricity. Because as the price of consumer goods increases, the use decreases. And that is the ultimate objective.
But now, is that really valid that America produces 80% of the pollution? Because we know that Russia is one of the most heavily polluted nations in the world, or at least what used to be the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. And, of course, we saw tremendous pollution all throughout Europe and their cars. I don't believe that 80% America makes 80% of the pollution. Is there any justification for that, or are they simply making up statistics?
Well, you know that statistics can be made to say whatever you want them to say. And it's a matter of measuring how you measure and then how you interpret the statistics. And there is a chart and a diagram that purports to document that assertion. But whether it's true or not is totally irrelevant. It is stated, declared, and accepted and announced that a consensus has been reached, then policy is based on that assumption, whether it's true or not.
In other words,
and that's precisely what we saw happen with the scientific evidence on climate change in the first place, and it happens repeatedly on the statistical analyses that comes from the United Nations.
Now, what are they going to do about cutting back on industrial production in Russia?
Well, Russia is supposed to be complying with these protocols, and Russia is one of the nations whose delegates officially oppose the implementation of this protocol.
Really?
Yes. Russia, it was strange. In the July session, when I was here in July, Russia made a very passionate and reasonable case against implementing the protocol in the first instance, and was argued down by Tim Wirth from the American delegation.
You don't think that's sort of like Briar Rabbit saying, "Peter, don't throw me in the cabbage patch. Don't throw me in the, I guess it was the thistle patch. Don't throw me in the thistle patch, Briar Rabbit." You know, in other words, arguing for something they really want to come to pass, because of course the Soviets would love to see the industrial capacity of America destroyed, and what you're really describing is the destruction of America's productive capacity,
yes,
or industrial capacity.
But it would also destroy Russia's production capacity, because Russia is far more dependent upon coal than we are, and dependent upon oil as well, but primarily upon coal, and their biggest resource is coal. And if they're not allowed to use coal, then they are in the same bind that America is, with less opportunity to develop expensive, sophisticated alternative technology.
Well, of course, you know, we could produce energy with nuclear power plants, and yet with no solid scientific basis, they've outlawed nuclear production, even though places like France, I think 70% of their electricity comes from nuclear, and Japan probably an equally high amount of their electricity, and yet America is not allowed to develop nuclear power, and so we remain dependent upon fossil fuels.
That's correct. Nuclear power will not be an alternative. The alternatives are photoelectronics, photovoltaics, alternative fuels such as ethanol and some of the other exotic fuels that are too terribly expensive to use, and we just don't have a solution out there on the horizon from technology.
Well, why won't they let us use nuclear? Because if you study nuclear, it's incredibly safe. The real reason you had a problem with Chernobyl was because they didn't have a container capsule. It was it wasn't a nuclear explosion at all. It was a steam explosion that simply dispersed the radioactive graphite all over. Had they had a container like we have in America, there wouldn't have been a problem. So why, we know how safe nuclear power is. Why won't they let us develop that?
Well, you and I may know that, Stan, but there is an organization called the Union of Concerned Scientists who organized shortly after the Second World War expressly for the purpose of eliminating nuclear power. They did a magnificent job of scaring the world to death, and the general public believes that nuclear power is unsafe, that it poses a potential catastrophic health risk to the entire world, and therefore we will not see any proliferation of nuclear power in this country for many years to come.
I sometimes think that we live in a world gone mad, and then other times I'm sure of it. Because all of these are contrived problems, and yet, and none of them need the solutions that are being put forward, and yet these solutions are intent upon destroying the industrial fabric, the foundation upon which our society is based. Would that be a fair statement?
That is an absolutely fair statement. The objective is to create a world built on socialist philosophy, that is governed or and managed by a central authority. And we are moving closer and closer to that goal every single day.
Well, it's a frightening thing to contemplate, but at least we have you there keeping us abreast of what's going on. And we have an opportunity to get this out, and I'll probably play the first half of this program on our afternoon, pardon me, our program in Los Angeles this coming Saturday, and we reach an awful lot of people with that. Henry, I want to thank you so very much for being our guest here on Radio Liberty, and please get in touch with us when you get back to the United States, and anything else that comes up, send us a fax so we can get the information out to our listeners. Thanks so very much, and may the Lord protect you.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Okay, fine.
Good night.
Well, okay, fine. Henry, we're off the air.
This tape is obtained from Radio Liberty. Their mailing address is P.O. Box 13, Santa Cruz, California. Zip is 95063. They have a large resource list and list of catalogs of books and tapes. You can write to them and get one, and they have a good source of information. God bless you now. Goodbye.